Okay. By the way, if you didn't get a handout as you came in, make sure you do. There are packets. You gotta have a packet. If you don't, you'll be lost. You gotta have one of these packets as you're coming in here. All right. There's one remaining over here and a couple remaining over there. We may have to have some more run off. We'll see. We've run off about 60 of them, I think, at this point, and we may have to run off some more. Okay, now, last time we were together, we talked about the controlling model of congregational leadership, and I tried to give you as quick an overview of this. By the way, this is normally an 8-hour workshop. So as you can see, I'm running through this thing in breakneck speed and wish I could slow down a little bit. And some of you have already indicated some questions that you have, and I'm happy to, you know, help you in whatever way I can with those questions. And if we don't get to do it now, my email address is at the bottom of the sheet, and my contact information there on page 2, so please feel free to contact me, and I'll be happy to chat with you about this. I mentioned also I work with Hope Network Mentoring Partners and do a lot of consulting and that sort of thing along these lines, so if I can be of help to your congregation as you're affecting whatever transitions you may be relative to your leadership model, I'm happy to help in that respect too. But I want us to shift, now that we've talked about the controlling model, and let's talk about the empowering model. In the empowering model, here's one way of visualizing it. I call it inverting the pyramid. Let me give you an idea as to the history of this presentation. It might help you. Back several years ago, you're familiar with Len Anderson and his book, They Smell Like Sheep. And Len had conducted several years of mentoring groups. And at one point, he decided, I've conducted all these mentoring groups. I've mentored probably hundreds. And he said, I'd like to take a few people and let me concentrate my time on them and let them then duplicate the work that I'm trying to go about. And one way he had of kicking that off was to do the National Shepherds Clinic. Some of you may have been to at least one or more of the National Shepherding Clinics. The first one we did was with the Northside Church in San Antonio, and the second one was at the Homewood Church in Birmingham. And we've not had any beyond that. That was back in 03 or 04 when we did the one in Birmingham. When we did the first one at Northside Church in San Antonio, Lynn said that he wanted me to take and to describe the nature of the shift from the controlling model to the shepherding model and just how, what was involved in a congregation going from one place to the next. That was the first iteration of this workshop. Back in 2002 at the Northside Church in San Antonio. And I tried to think of the best way of conveying how radical a shift it is. And the best way I knew how to do that was to call it inverting the pyramid. Because if you remember the controlling model, we started here, right? A top-down model. And I suggested that it, at least philosophically, to start getting our heads around it, what we have to do is turn the pyramid upside down. Now, I realize that turning the pyramid upside down communicates some things, but it doesn't communicate other things. I get that. But I think, at least philosophically, this is where we have to start. And understanding that leadership that is empowering starts from the bottom up. The idea being that we are doing everything we can as a leadership team to empower and to unleash our congregation into various forms of ministry effectiveness. Now, the idea being, however, that you're operating on a biblical foundation of Christ and the apostles, you have some sense of shared congregational purpose. Now, a lot of times the way that's expressed in our models today is mission, values, and vision, what I call corporate core content. It's a model that we've borrowed from corporate America, and in some cases it works beautifully, in other cases it doesn't. It just depends on how you work to embed those understandings into congregational life. We're really good at expressing those kinds of things. It's really not hard to express mission, vision, and values. I mean, it's a process putting the statements together. I teach a course called Church Leadership Strategies at HST where we talk about this. We talk about how do you do mission, vision, values, and that kind of thing. It's another thing altogether to embed those into congregational culture. Embedding a new culture, creating a new congregational culture is much harder than putting the statements together. But the assumption being that if you have this shared sense of congregational purpose and it is indeed embedded into congregational life, then As everyone shares that understanding of why the church exists, then hopefully then you can have a servant leader team where the, as the old statement goes, the elders elder and the deacons deacon, the ministers do whatever the ministers do, because to be honest with you, in churches of Christ, that's something that's going, we're going to have to work harder to settle than this model can settle. But knowing where our ministers fit in the mix is something that we're going to be having to deal with, I think, for a long time. As I mentioned to you in working with Hope Network Mentoring Partners, the number one issue that we are asked to deal with is church governance. Who decides? Who decides? And knowing where the ministers fit is still tough, but it's easier to put the ministers in this mix because very often they serve as part of a servant leadership team to where it's very rare for the elders and ministers not to meet together. I like to refer to that though as inhale and exhale, that the elders need to meet sometimes as themselves, the ministers need to meet sometimes as themselves, but there need to be readily understood rhythms where the elders and ministers meet together on a consistent basis, and it be rare that important decisions for the direction of the church are not where they're not brought together in the doing of that. Now, but you can see how this operates. Now, the intent is for the leaders to serve, to empower, to equip, that there be shared authority and streamlined structure. Streamlined structure meaning that you're doing everything you can to throw off the chains and lock in the gains and throw off the create new strains. You're doing everything you can with structure to keep it lean, but at the same time effective enough that things get done. There are some tendencies with this, though. There's some negative tendencies even with us understanding. One of them is you can swing the pendulum from one extreme, control, to another extreme, chaos. Sometimes people want to shift to this model not because they want they really want the power to be shared. They just want it to be transferred. I don't want the elders to have power because I want power. All right, and when it's done for that purpose, it's really not a good model. That's really chaotic for that to occur. And it can also be a somewhat spiritualistic, I call it almost Gnostic response, to where we're saying, you know, the reason why we want this is because we don't want there to be any structure, we don't want there to be any leadership, we just all want to be able to do what we want to do. And let's just, quote, let go and let God. And we spiritualize this sense of no structure within our churches, no clear understanding of who, quote unquote, is in charge and that sort of thing. I'm not suggesting that either. By the way, if you want some good reading on this, there's an old book, been around for a long time, by Norman Schatzhack, Managing the Congregation, Building Effective Systems to Serve the People. It's been around for a long time, but still good. Some were of Paul, some were of Apollos, some of Cephas. I am of Schatzhack. Schatzhack's a good author, and some of his books have been around for a while, but he had a really, really good understanding of the way churches work. Now, here's another way of being able to visualize the same thing. It's often referred to as a cluster model. Now, I will give you my opinion. I think it's very difficult to find a specific structure in Scripture. I think there are a whole lot of different structures that can work depending on one's locale, depending upon one's ministry context. Many are finding that structures similar to this work really well, where the elders and ministers, in seeking to follow Christ's will for the church, function in overseeing the work of a few deacons and ministry coordinators who then oversee a significant cluster of the ministries and so on. A whole lot of different ways of organizing it, but you can see that this is a way of being able to visualize an empowering model. Now, Frost and Hirsch and their book, Shaping of Things to Come, have developed an even different way of looking at it that I think has some merit, where they begin with this notion that we're living in a missionary post-Christian culture that is a part of the anxious postmodern era in which we would love to see God's reign, His kingdom, come to fruition within this setting. And so the church functions as a post-Christendom mission outpost and the pilgrim people moving in a kingdom direction through an empowered congregation with ministers, elders, and deacons working together, making sure that they are expressing the kind of currencies of influence that we find, for example, in Ephesians chapter 4 with the apostles and prophets and evangelists and shepherds and teachers, where we're not necessarily thinking there about offices, but thinking of currencies of influence, the kind of giftedness that leaders often have. Now, all I'm doing there is presenting three different ways of being able to conceive of this notion of empowering, unleashing the church to be able to do the ministry that we've called them to do over against a more controlling model. Now, if you'll look there on page 12, actually page 13, in looking at these characteristics, you'll see that each of these characteristics are, in a sense, kind of a contrasting statement to the controlling model. And if it would help, as we're doing this, for you to just be able to look at the chart that compares them side by side, you will see that chart on pages 20 and 21 that compares the controlling and the empowering model side by side there on page 20. All right, but let's walk specifically through each of these characteristics. First, the textual focus, usually, of an empowering model is Matthew chapter 20. The notion of where Jesus says, you know, you have Gentiles who lord it over them, but not so among you. The first among you shall be your servant. The idea that you're operating here from that perspective, 1 Peter chapter 5, one of those phrases that describes shepherding the flock is not lording it over the flock, but serving as examples. And so this notion that you're wanting your leadership to be based more upon your moral authority than on your positional authority. And again, not to say, and I want to make sure that I've said this, I'm not trying to suggest that elders should not understand their role as having positional authority within our churches. I think they do, and I think that should be maintained. It's a question of how it's used and using it as judiciously as we can and making sure that we're actually using that power with and for others rather than over others on a constant basis. But if 1 Peter chapter 5 is one of those texts that tends to underscore that. Ephesians 4, the notion that the reason why we have these currencies of leadership influence in the church is so that the church actually matures, grows, and develops into Christ. And if you remember, one of the characteristics I underscored about the controlling model is that it's developmentally restrictive. It's very difficult for people to grow and to mature in that understanding of things. The primary metaphor for this, if you remember, the primary metaphor in the previous one was monarchy. The primary metaphor here is under shepherd, servant leader, spiritual director, sage. We could probably list several others. The type of authority tends to be more relational and moral, traditional. What we mean by traditional, the kind of authority that you see in wisdom figures within religious communities. The use of power, it's understood that power belongs to God and leaders share power with and for others to liberate and expand ministry opportunities. The scope of authority tends to be more situational, with shared decision-making residing in the ones who are doing the ministry, with less frequent developmental and maturational directives from the elders. The method of organization tends to be more partnership-based, where each one is a minister covenanting with others on ministry teams with a lean, quick, and permission-giving kind of structure. The philosophy of management tends to be more stewardship, with increasingly selectively self-directed people based on high trust and mutual accountability. As we continue, the method of decision-making. Leaders involve others in making macro decisions about shared purpose and equip others to make their own choices in the operations of ministry. The philosophy of ministry is that we see ourselves as ministry partners who are liberated and equipped to confidently employ gifts in unity with others, taking risk in order to make the most meaningful difference. Provision of ministry training is where the leaders actually budget for and provide exposure to new ideas and resources to increase the church's competence, confidence, and creativity. The view of people is more of one of trust and hopefulness, where you view them as responsible and trustworthy and creative and resourceful and valuable gifts from God, endowed by the Spirit. Role of elders tends to be more mentoring, teaching, and equipping and nurturing. And then the role of the members, the priesthood, called into incarnational ministry according to gifts and calling, compelled by the church's kingdom vision and guided by the elders. The role of the deacons are model servants with spiritual qualities to guide ministries governed by the church's vision. The role of paid ministry staff, trusted, accountable co-laborers with the elders, deacons, and each other empowered to lead others into externally focused ministry. Now, if you will look, by the way, do we have an extra handout? We got one more over there. Is that right? Can we pass it this direction, please? Thank you. If you'll look there on pages 20 and 21, again, there is the comparison chart. There's a comparison chart there, trying to look at these two. And I'll give you a chance to read through the comparison chart, because I think probably more than any other place, the comparison chart brings this together. I'll give you a chance to read through that. Pages 20 and 21. Reach from left to right and then down. Okay, now, let's go back to page 15. Let's talk about some challenges relative to the empowering model. And again, this is a short workshop. This is 3 hours. Some of you brought questions, comments to me, you know, as we were in the in-between. But I realized that as soon as you try to institute this empowering model, it has its own challenges. Okay, one of the challenges is it's hard for elders to let go. Another is it's hard for deacons sometimes to step up to the plate. Deacons and ministry coordinators sometimes don't want to step up to the plate. There are a lot of challenges relative to this model. I certainly understand those. I'd rather bite off those challenges than I would deal with the fact that you don't achieve what I think you can achieve without this. But I realize it has its stuff, too. Now, in that respect, and I'm going to skip through these operating principles, let's look at some of these challenges. Number one, shifting to an empowering model may be an overreaction to control. I do some consulting for churches. Sometimes as a consultant, I have to work hard before I get there to make sure that I'm not being brought in as a hitman. As the guy with the briefcase from out of town who just comes and shoots and leaves, blows in, blows up, and blows out. And a lot of times I get calls from people who say, we need you to come set our elders straight on this control thing. And I like to ask several questions when that happens, because I'm trying to determine, is it just a shift in the balance of power that you're wanting, or do you really want an empowerment model? Because sometimes the desire to shift to this is not that we want everybody to be empowered. It's that I want power. Okay. Now, most of the time, even if that's said, if you get right down underneath it, it really is that people want shared power. It's just that they have been unempowered for so long that they just say, let me come in and take charge. You know, I think I can do things a little bit better. When in reality, you'd end up with the same thing. So you have to be careful. But it can be an overreaction to control. If you'll see the comments I've given there on page 15. At times, this model simply swings the pendulum from one extreme to the other, continuing the dichotomy between servant and directive leadership. There's not, servant leadership and directive leadership are not opposites. That's important to keep in mind. Number two, it can be a spiritualistic overcorrection to technocracy, disparaging structure in the interest of just trusting God and being led by the Spirit. Now, let me define what I mean by that. Look at the, I'm borrowing here from Christian Schwartz, where he talks about the technocratic paradigm versus the spiritualistic paradigm. The technocratic paradigm is that the significance of institutions, programs, and methods is overestimated. The spiritualistic is the significance of institutions, programs, and methods are underestimated. And the whole notion of, and I won't go over every detail I've given you there, there are some who have this notion that any kind of church organization or church structure, or any time you actually have a clear system of who decides, that somehow that it doesn't give room for the Spirit to work. As if the Spirit of God doesn't like structure. I really don't find that in the New Testament. Structure is good. Structure is good. Too much structure is not. But have you ever been in an environment that had too little? And, you know, we're going to talk here in session three that energy of a congregation always goes the path of least resistance. In a controlling model, it, you know, the energy is blocked, okay? In an overcorrected model, where it's a highly spiritualistic model, it becomes just chaotic, scattered energy. And you don't, you actually get less done that way within congregations than if you have something that is in between those two. So I'm not at all trying to suggest that we're not talking here about a pendulum swing. We're talking about here what I think can be a very healthy correction of an overly controlling model. Number three, it may also digress into extremes of disengagement. Let me give you an example. The elders meant well, they meant extremely well, by putting a committee over the process of selecting a minister. I was serving as a consultant, and I worked primarily with the committee. You know how that works. The committee had put together a system of interviews, weekend visits, and they said, we would like for you to look at this and especially give us a perspective as to what these ministry candidates are going to experience as they come in with this kind of visit, as the way we have it structured. They had an entire four-day weekend scheduled where they were going to bring in their three top candidates and then decide upon the one. And then, now it wasn't the preacher parade, okay? They weren't going to do that. They were just going to do some interviewing, preliminary interviewing with select committees, and from that three to select one, which is not necessarily a bad model. And when they put those weekends together, there was not one meeting they had scheduled to where the minister and the prospective minister and his wife were going to meet with the elders. Not one. I went to the elders about that. I said, were you aware of this? Well, we're trying to empower our people. I said, okay. I said, it may be a bit of an overshift here for you to do it this way. But I can assure you the ministers will not make a decision about whether to come to a church until they've sat down with the elders. Because once they get settled, they're not going to be working with the committee. That committee's ad hoc. That committee's not going to be there. When they get there, they're going to be working with the elders. And they said, well, we're right. Okay, I guess, yeah. You need to put in some elder meeting time. It needs to be long. Because that's where these guys are going to be making their decision. Because preachers, what's the fundamental criterion that you're using to decide whether you're compatible with the congregation? The eldership. All right. Now, the members, I've worked with a lot of churches on this. The members don't seem to get this. They think he's going to come here because of the community and the schools and the nature of our congregation and the opportunity and that kind of thing. When in reality, the way the minister's looking at it is, what kind of elders am I going to be working with? And so he, you know, they needed to have those meetings. It was a good thing for them to do, and they made some changes, and I think it was a good process that they went toward. But that was a case of disengagement, where the elders had disengaged too much in an attempt to empower. I can think of another case where they appointed a committee of people, say, we're going to select some deacons. And the group came up with a set of deacon candidates, three of whom the elders were in pretty continual counseling sessions with them and their wives because their marriages were not healthy. And the rest of the congregation didn't know it because the elders were following a confidentiality policy and they were doing their best to be discreet about it. Had those guys been vetted by the elders, which they needed to be, there needed to be some vetting by the elders. Had that happened, then they would not have made the mistake of putting those guys before the congregation and then having to pull them away. It was very embarrassing. The elders could have saved those guys that embarrassment and saved the committee that embarrassment if there had been some degree of vetting that went on before the names were actually put forward. So empowerment doesn't mean you just take the elders completely out of the picture. It doesn't mean that at all. I know you have churches who want empowerment because that's what they're wanting to accomplish. They want to just take the elders out of the picture at all. That's not what we're suggesting. It's a matter of how this kind of power is distributed within the church. So it can digress into the extremes of disengagement, and that's not what we're looking at either. Also, another thing to keep in mind, facilitating a change of this magnitude is long-term and complex. Now, you can have short-term wins relative to it within a few months, but getting it to the point to where this understanding is actually deeply embedded into the culture of the church takes 7 to 10 years. And that is not an exaggeration. There's one church I've worked with where I've probably worked with them more than any other. They are in their 8th year of this. And they believe it is finally embedded into their church. Here's how you know it's embedded into your church. When you can appoint new elders into the mix and not worry about whether it popping back to what it was before. That's when you know it's really embedded. But even then, you're going to have to retrain. Now, this comes from sort of a baptism of the John Cotter model for long-term change. And I'll talk more about that as we get into it. In session 3 is where we're actually going to talk about the change model and just what is involved in this kind of thing. All right. Then number 5, change efforts often become derailed by self-sabotage. Look there if you'll see on letter A underneath that, 5A there on page 16. Both those who want change and those who do not may derail partnership and stewardship. Leaders should never underestimate the power of homeostasis. Without a well-designed change process, progress will stall and the homeostatic forces will pull the congregation back into old patterns. Now, I'm giving there a little illustration from Pete Steinke. I won't read through it, but it's actually a story that he draws from those who had the first cataract surgeries. Now, some of you may have actually had that operation. I never have had that. But it was my understanding in the history of that those who had the first cataract surgeries, many of them had such difficulty adjusting to the fact that they could see that they began to actually put patches over their eyes and preferred blindness to sight because they had become so accustomed to a world without sight that the world with sight was overwhelming to them. And they preferred the old way. Proportion and distance and things like that were just, it was the first human being they saw. When they saw themselves, it was overwhelming because they'd had a tendency to see themselves in very small proportions. But when they actually saw another human being, when they looked at color, when they saw the size of trees, and things like that, it just blew their minds. And many of them actually preferred blindness to sight. Now, it's the power of homeostasis. And it can happen with congregations as well. Let me give you a few examples. If you'll look there on page 18, letter B, there are various ways that this can happen with regard to the shift from control to empowerment. 1, elders can become frustrated with the messiness of helping others grow. You remember me mentioning the controlling model is more efficient. It's more efficient. It isn't necessarily more effective, but it is more efficient. 2, members who are accustomed to elders running the church pressure the elders to step up and lead. You get that? 3, members find zones of resistance to the congregational direction within the eldership and try to manipulate the elders into pushing for a certain agenda. 4, newer elders who have not been a part of a change to an empowerment model bring in the traditional hierarchical understanding and damage the effectiveness of the team. 5, ministers or members consistently violate the trust of the elders. We could add to that list. Deacons aren't willing to step up to the plate and still want the elders to make decisions. You can't find deacons who are willing to be responsible with it. I mean, the list, it takes a while to get a church in this mode. I think it's worth it. I think it's tremendously worth it. But it is constant work. It actually, in the early going, makes the work of the elders more difficult, not less. The transitional period can be overwhelming for churches, to be able to operate in this way. Now, I made a few suggestions as to what can be done along those lines, but I want to move on to something that I think will probably be a little more helpful. All right. What kind of time do I have for session two here? Let me see. Oh, good. I have 28 minutes. No, actually, a little less than that, but preacher time, 28 minutes. All right. Turn, if you would, to page 22. Let's talk about how do you stay on track with this? How do you actually help a church get from point A to point B with this? First off, let's do a little review, remembering the principles of effective ministry leadership design. A brief overview of these principles. Number one, we generate the people in ministry we design for, not what we merely hope for. You remember we mentioned that in the first session. Number two, the two components of ministry design are structures and belief systems. And we gave illustrations of both. But that number three, belief systems hold the power behind the structures. And so that's why we spent such a long time talking about the difference between the controlling and the empowering belief system. Now let me go a little farther with a few more principles. One is, mission and ministry consume energy. Spirituality and vision produce energy. But ministry system design, structures and belief systems, block, channel, or scatter energy. Now, let me stay on this a little while. By the way, this is one of the reasons why this workshop is generally 6 to 8 hours rather than three. But this is important to get. Now, mission and ministry consume energy. Perfect example, VBS. You ever done Vacation Bible School? All right, you know what I'm talking about. I remember the first church I preached for, the Cordova Church over in Memphis, while I was going through grad school back in the 80s. And we didn't have elders at the time. And I started there in the spring. And they said, Carlos, VBS is coming up. I said, I'd rather conjugate Greek verbs. I mean, that was really what I would rather do. I mean, I just had a preference for in-depth Bible study, preaching the word. Acts 6 gives me my job description. You do not. Okay. I was young. I had to do VBS. Now, I've got the administrative stuff to do it. It wasn't that. And I can lead the, you know, Father Abraham songs, and they're fun to do. All right. But I never led a VBS. Somebody encouraged me. By the way, they don't train you how to do VBS at preacher school. I went to Lipscomb for my undergrad. I didn't have one course in VBS. To be honest with you, they don't have time to do all that training. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff they have to cover. They don't have time to cover VBS. I didn't know how to do VBS. So somebody encouraged me to go to the Baptist bookstore. Because, after all, they do it better than anybody else. So I walk into the Baptist bookstore. That place was huge. I mean, it was just massive. I was a little overwhelmed walking in. And this nice lady looks at me. She says, can I help you? There in Memphis. I said, yep. I got to do a VBS. Oh, is this your first Vacation Bible School? Are you a young preacher? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. She said, oh, let me help you. She took me by, she said, listen, it's not, I'm telling you the honest truth. She took me by the arm and she led me to the row there at the store that had all the VBS stuff. Because it was about 10 of these rooms long. I mean, it was just, it was like a warehouse full of stuff. And she walked me through and she said, now you need this to start out with because it gives you a checklist 6 months ahead, 5 months ahead, 4 months ahead, 3 weeks ahead. She said, it just gives you a checklist of stuff you've got to do in getting this organized. That was a godsend. It was wonderful. By the way, I operate with checklists right now, that way now with all of my projects. I do that kind of project management. And it sort of got me, you know, trained to do it that way. Man, by the time that VBS was over, I was wiped. out. Oh, man, tired. Everybody who was involved in it was tired. You know, and somebody was asking about that. They actually had a gospel meeting planned for 2 weeks after it in the original schedule. And I got that canceled. I said, we're not doing that. I'm sorry, we're just not. I said, not if you expect me to stay awake during those presentations. I just can't do it. It killed me. Now, was it a good thing? Yeah. Man, yeah, it was a great thing. I'm glad we did it. There are a lot of kids whose lives are really blessed by VBS, especially neighborhood kids, who are touched in a way that nothing else will. Well, that consumes a lot of energy. You're putting yourself out, right? What produces energy? Spirituality and vision. Having a sense of the future you think God will bring about as you're faithful in mission, vision. Your own spirituality, and I would even say the spirituality of the congregation as is expressed in esprit de corps, the lightness of the step. Thomas Jefferson once said, when the heart is right, the feet are swift. And there's something about that when people feel good about congregational life, there is this sense of, hey, man, we want to do stuff. And that creates energy. It does. It creates it. Now, ministry system design can either take that energy and either block it, channel it, or scatter it. It can either block it, channel it, or scatter it. All right? Now, in this respect, the energy of the congregation always follows the path of least resistance. In a controlling model, the path of least resistance is to maintain what exists. It's blocked energy. It's to maintain the status quo. Or, another way of talking about that is what Gil Rendell refers to as pursuing the illusion of congregational happiness. Want to make everybody happy. All right? But that is an illusion. Because every decision to make one group happy makes another group unhappy. It is an illusion. You have to have a bigger set of criteria for making your decisions than making people happy. But in a controlling model, that's what we're doing. We're maintaining the status quo. We're not rocking the boat. We want to keep what exists. That's blocked energy. Because energy is creative. Energy is creative. And the more creative you are, the more difficult it is to operate in systems like this. So now, in an empowering model, which we're looking at here, the path of least resistance is to equip the church for ministry. That's channeled energy. You remember me giving the illustration on the front end of one of the reasons why I was attracted to Johnson Bible College, Johnson University, is because the philosophy the dean had of administrating faculty, where he said, I hire faculty who don't need control, they don't need supervision, and I'll let you go and I'll let you do your work. And I give you all the resources I can to help you get it done. All right, now that's channeled energy. The path of least resistance in that situation is to be charged with a role and to fulfill it with all your might. That's the path of least resistance. Nobody pays any attention to what you're doing sometimes, and the realization is, though, that you're free to do whatever you need and want to do relative to your ministry. You're evaluated periodically, and you know what those set standards of evaluation are going to be, and those were good evaluations for me. Everything I did was evaluated. So being empowered doesn't mean you're not evaluated. In fact, to have an empowering system, we need good systems of ministry evaluation that's happening within our churches. But, again, in this empowering model, the path of least resistance is to equip the church for ministry. You're channeling the energy. Now, in a disengaged model, the path of least resistance is individualism without accountability. I call that scattered, unstable, and chaotic energy. We're not wanting this, and we're not wanting this. We're wanting this. Okay, we don't want A or C. We want B. Now, there are four major energy inhibitors, bottlenecks. It's when the leadership focuses too much attention on maintaining their authority that it diverts attention, energy away from other purposes. Another is limiting factors, inadequacies in the design. Another is a lack of clear purpose, where ministry teams have no ideas as to what they need to accomplish. And another is low administrative accountability. Ministry units function without structural or theological accountability, and the energy of the congregation scattered into chaotic and competing array of efforts that suffer from the absence of a united congregational spirit. Now, the goal, if you'll look on the next page, on page 23, the goal is to alter the belief systems and structures from a controlling or disengaged model to an empowering model, allowing the energy that comes from the congregation's spirituality to be channeled toward fulfilling a shared kingdom vision. Look at that again. Just read through that. That's your goal. That's what we're wanting, obviously, is to alter the belief systems and structures from a controlling or disengaged model to an empowering model, allowing the energy that comes from the congregation's spirituality to be channeled toward fulfilling a shared kingdom vision. However, when you're on this transition trail, there are some challenges. Let me see how much time I have. Just enough to go over this. All right, so here we go. Now you see this. We're talking about unhealthy on each end. All right, you get that? Transitional phases in between and what we would call the healthiest expression in the middle. All right? So as churches are transitioning into this model, there are various places along this trail. Most churches begin the transition trail starting from the left of the continuum and moving toward the center. Most churches start somewhere in this controlling area. They start to the left of this continuum and they try to make progress toward the right. Okay? That making sense so far? That's where most churches start. In that respect, let's say you've got a controlling belief system and a controlling structure and that's where you're starting. Not uncommonly, what happens is you adopt a controlling belief system with an empowering structure. You say, we're going to structure things so that people can, that the elders could and the deacons to deacon, the ministers and the people are free to do what they need to do, but then you still have a controlling belief system. You haven't really changed the belief system, and so no matter how you try to work with that structure, it won't get things done. You'll pop back into it. Look at the way I've described that in letter B there on page 23. You there with me? A description. Ministry systems are set up, but elders and ministers are not able to let go. They frequently intervene, second-guess, and micromanage. An example. Elders set up a finance ministry that, working collaboratively with the staff, sets up an expense reporting system that some ministry leaders have difficulty accepting. These ministry leaders complain directly to the elders, who allow them to ignore the new policies and assure them that they will deal with the finance committee. You've still got the controlling belief system at work there. Even though you set up a structure, you still got the controlling belief system. All right? You can also have an empowering belief system, but a controlling structure. That can still happen. Look at the way I've described that. Letter C. Description. It's rare for a belief system to change without the structure following, but it may take a while for the structure to catch up. Example. Elders want to make the shift to empowerment, but implement a system of record keeping and reporting that is so cumbersome that ministry leaders feel overwhelmed by the time spent in meetings and paperwork. So that's where you've set up an empowering belief system, but you still have a controlling structure. Okay, which probably, to be honest with you, means that you're still operating with a little bit of that old controlling belief system. All right. Next, many churches, in an attempt to become more empowering, may actually move to the right of the continuum into an overshifted or chaotic pattern, or perhaps even to the point of an indulgent laissez-faire model. For example, if you'll look here, an empowering belief system, but an overshifted structure. Look at the way I've described that. Letter D, top of page 24. Description. The ministry system is put in place that frees ministry leaders to operate without excessive control, but either the ministry leaders lack the understanding necessary to function well, or the elders fail to execute administrative accountability. This may be an issue of too much too soon. An example. A deacon is placed over the children's ministry who quickly makes several unilateral decisions without involving those who work in that ministry. He lacks the understanding necessary to execute his role. Or, elders appoint a committee to direct the deacon selection process. The elders pull away. but fail to give any theological direction as to the qualities necessary for deacons or to set accountability process, procedures, and sequence that would allow them to advise the committee along the way. And as a result, unqualified deacon candidates are set before the congregation. So that's an empowering belief system, but a bit of an overshifted structure to where there's too much too soon. Another one can be an empowering belief system and a chaotic structure. I've given you a description of that. And you can also have one that has a fairly laissez-faire structure with an empowering belief system to where pretty much anything goes. Now, what you're hoping for is a congregation may have leaders and members who are at different stages along the continuum concurrently causing a fluid movement. You're hoping for some settlement into this, but my experience has been that off and on it will have a tendency to have little pendulum swings from side to side here in the center. Are you with me there? There'll always be the need for some corrections. What you're hoping for is that the swings are not dramatic, but that the swings stay within here as much as possible, and that you have minor corrections that need to be done along the way with various kinds of training. All right. Now, well, I just set a record. I have never covered this in 50 minutes. It is about time for us to take the next break. When we come back, I want to start on page 26. Now, what time is our next session? It's at 3 this afternoon? Okay. When we come back for the next session at 3, we'll start on page 26, where we talk about the magnitude and complexity of the change process and some of the other pieces that are involved in shifting to an empowering model. So we start being a little more practical and talking about steps that can be taken to help the congregation move in this direction. Okay. Well, come back at 3. Let's, bring your friends and your neighbors and, you know, maybe we'll have some more of these handouts copied as well. Thank you guys very much for being a part of it.